Hello, welcome to this webinar on corporate insolvency. I'm Ollie Hyams from Gatehouse Chambers, speaking together with Phil Patterson, also from Gatehouse Chambers, and Alex Neal from Debenhams Otterway Solicitors. We'll be speaking about recent developments and expected trends in corporate insolvency law. Turning to the first slide, last June, Parliament passed the Corporate Insolvency and Governance Act 2020, better known as SIGA. It had a rapid passage through the UK parliamentary process, making its way from first publication on 20th of May to royal assent on the 25th of June, so in just over 5 weeks. Some of the measures had been planned for a long time. Others were emergency response measures introduced specifically in response to the pandemic. The permanent measures introduced include two new insolvency processes known as the moratorium and the restructuring plan. I'll talk about those a little later on. SIGA also introduced pandemic-specific measures. The most important ones for present purposes are the introduction of restrictions on the presentation of one-year petitions and the relaxation of the wrongful trading rules. I'll talk about the former and Phil will talk about the latter. SIGA also introduces a temporary and more flexible version of the moratorium and changes the rules around filings and meetings to make them more pandemic-friendly, but those are really beyond the scope of today's seminar. Next slide, please. Schedule 10 of SIGA contains provisions restricting the presentation of winding up petitions and the making of winding up orders. The key provisions include the following, and this is just a brief reminder for present purposes. So a petition cannot be issued in the relevant period, and that's between the 27th of April 2020 until the 30th of September 2021, based on the statutory demand served between the 1st of March 2020 and the 30th of September 2021. No petition can be issued during this relevant period unless the creditor has reasonable grounds for believing that either COVID-19 has not had a financial impact on the company, or the debt would have arisen even if COVID-19 had not had an impact on the company. And increasingly, this is becoming known as the coronavirus test. SIGA also prevents the making of a winding up order where it appears to the court that coronavirus had a financial effect on the company before presentation of the petition, unless the court finds that the ground for insolvency would have arisen anyway. Now, this doesn't apply to all petitions. So, for example, petitions brought in the public interest can still be presented without these restrictions, but we'll look at how these apply in practice in a bit more detail now. Parliament's clear intention was to prevent aggressive creditor action and to encourage consensual discussions between parties. Otherwise, there could have been a wave of winding up petitions and subsequent liquidations as businesses struggled in the early stages of the pandemic. Has it worked? Well, in my experience, creditors are slow to present winding up petitions at present, and it's generally understood that the court will scrutinise creditor petitions very carefully. In practice, creditor petitions are presented for a preliminary hearing to see whether they meet the coronavirus test and are only permitted to proceed if they appear to do so. At the final hearing of a petition, the court will take a creditor-friendly approach in general. If coronavirus has had any negative effect on the company, and even if the company adduces limited evidence of this, the court's likely to dismiss the petition. And that's the approach that was taken by ICC Judge Barber in Rear Company. That's the case on the slide. So what we have in practice is creditors being slow to present petitions and the court being slow to grant them. Let's look at what that's meant for the numbers of winding up orders being made by the courts. We see those numbers on the next slide. So here we see the number of company liquidations since the start of the first lockdown compared with the previous period. The black line, that's the total number of insolvencies. The green line, right at the bottom, dashed, is the number of compulsory liquidations. What we can see there is that there's been an overall decline and a sharper decline in compulsory liquidations. Let's look at those numbers in a bit more detail, and that's on the next slide. The numbers are in fact somewhat surprising. There were only 31 compulsory liquidations in May 2021. That's down 89% from the same month 2 years earlier. It appears that the legislation, that's SIGA, has been extraordinarily effective at preventing creditors from obtaining compulsory winding up orders. Delving a little bit deeper into the numbers, administrations are far less common than they were even a year ago, whereas CVL numbers have remained broadly constant. So that's the effect. If we turn to the next slide, we can see and think about what might happen next. As I said a moment ago, the measures have been effective at avoiding a slew of compulsory liquidations, but the measures are temporary. What happens when they end? Lots of businesses across different sectors, hospitality, retail, tourism and the like, have accumulated trade and other debts that they won't be able to discharge after the temporary measures end on the 30th of September this year. Discussions in Parliament and policy circles about how a cliff edge can be avoided, that's to say so that creditors don't suddenly present petitions on the 1st of October, have been ongoing, but there are no simple answers. And a review of Hansard suggests that the government is still deep in thought about what can be done. It appears inevitable that the restrictions on the presentation of winding up petitions will have to be eased slowly, and that financial support for struggling businesses will have to continue beyond September. The government is also considering introducing compulsory arbitration for disputes between commercial landlords and tenants, where the tenant is struggling to meet liabilities under a commercial lease. It's a balancing act, though. There are potentially negative consequences for keeping plainly insolvent companies artificially afloat. They can run up further trade debts with impacts up and down the supply chain, creating problems for other businesses when those debts go unpaid later. Likewise, the directors of those insolvent companies may later find themselves in breach of the rules around insolvent trading or in breach of their duty to consider creditors' interests when it's clear that insolvency is likely. Let's now turn to consider the permanent measures that have been introduced by SIGA on the next slide. So two key permanent reforms have been introduced by SIGA, and I'll provide a very brief refresher on these. First is the introduction of the moratorium. It's a freestanding process that's similar in practice to a light-touch administration, where the intention is to rescue the company as a going concern. The directors are left in charge of the company, but a monitor, who's a qualified insolvency practitioner, is appointed at the same time to oversee the process. It aims to give the company much-needed breathing space to formulate a rescue plan without incurring very substantial costs, and as such, there are restrictions on legal action against the company and restrictions on insolvency process being initiated against the company when it's under a moratorium. Next, the restructuring plan. Well, this is a flexible court-supervised restructuring process. It's a compromise or arrangement between the company and its creditors, including secured creditors and or shareholders, and it can be proposed by any of them. It's influenced by the scheme of arrangement procedure, which is well established, but with enhancements, including what's known as the cross-class cram-down provisions, by which dissenting classes of creditors can be bound to the plan. In practice, often it's the directors of a company that initiate the process, and they will prepare a restructuring plan proposal and apply to court for approval to convene meetings of the company's creditors and members. There's then a second hearing at which the proposal can be adopted. Next slide, we look at how these processes have been used in practice. It's been a bit of a mixed bag. Only four moratoriums have been obtained in the year or so since the procedure was introduced, but nine restructuring plans have been registered at Companies House. And there's a growing consensus that the restructuring plan is a useful tool. It's been used already in a variety of different scenarios and is gaining momentum. We'll look briefly now at a case where a restructuring plan was sanctioned by the court and one where it never got quite that far. So first, the one where the court sanctioned the scheme. In May, the High Court approved a restructuring plan for companies in the Virgin Active Group, and it did so in the face of very significant creditor opposition, landlord opposition in particular, and the court imposed a cross-class cram-down on creditors, binding them to the plan. In doing so, the court recognised that the group companies faced an urgent liquidity crisis and the insolvency process was inevitable if the plan was not approved. In fact, the court said that an administration was pretty much inevitable if the plan wasn't sanctioned there and then. Mr. Justice Snowden was persuaded that no member of the dissenting creditor classes would be worse off than they would have been in an administration. And so the plans ought to go ahead. Even more recently, and this was at the end of June, in an application by Hurricane Energy PLC, a fracking company, Mr. Justice Zaccaroli declined to sanction a plan in the face of opposition from one of the two largest shareholders in the company. He essentially distinguished this case from Virgin Active by pointing out that Rather than facing an immediate insolvency process, the company was likely in the short to medium term to continue trading profitably. It was only in the long term that it would face a wall of debt, as it was described in the evidence, when certain bonds failed to be repaid, and it was unlikely that in a year or two's time, the company was going to be able to repay them. So he thought that this was a very different scenario from the Virgin Active case. But more than this, it was for the company to demonstrate that the shareholders would not be better off if they retained their shares and the company continued trading for at least the next year, but it could not do so. Basically, the plan was not good for shareholders, and the application could not succeed in light of this, and so it was not approved. This shows, to some extent, the perils of proposing a plan precipitously before the company is facing any real and immediate risk of insolvency. It appears that the permanent reforms introduced by Siegel will take some time to bed in, as insolvency practitioners and the legal profession grow accustomed to the new rules and procedures. A greater understanding of how the courts and creditors are likely to approach the process is likely to lead to their more widespread adoption. And as more cases come through the pipeline and there are more reported decisions, there'll be greater certainty for all involved. Both processes for now appear to be preserved for larger and more complex businesses. Certainly, that's true in respect of the restructuring plan. There are further restructuring plans likely to be sent to the court for approval soon, with further showdowns between companies and unhappy landlords of virtual certainty.
Thank you, Ollie. One of the headline temporary measures in the Corporate Insolvency and Governance Act is what is described in the legislation as being the suspension of wrongful trading. Now, before we look at the provisions themselves, it's necessary to say a few words about what wrongful trading is and what the pre-pandemic law said. The law in relation to wrongful trading is contained in sections 214 and 246ZB of the Insolvency Act 1986. The former concerns companies in liquidation and the latter concerns companies in administration. And on this slide, I've put subsection 2 of section 214, which sets out the scope of the provision insofar as it relates to companies in liquidation. On the next slide, in my view, one of the best textbooks in relation to corporate insolvency matters generally and wrongful trading in particular is Professor Good's book on the principles of corporate insolvency law. And on this slide, you'll see that I've noted that he identified four elements of wrongful trading. The first is that the company has entered insolvent liquidation or administration. And the point that I note on the slide is that it doesn't include members' voluntary liquidation, because by definition, that is not an insolvent liquidation. The second requirement is that at some point before the commencement of the winding up or administration, a person knew or ought to have concluded that there was no reasonable prospect that the company would avoid going into insolvent liquidation or administration. The third point is that that person was a director of the company at that time. And the fourth requirement is that the director fails to establish the statutory defence of taking every step that he or she ought to have taken to minimise the potential loss to creditors. Although the court's powers are fairly broad, the usual order that's made following a successful wrongful trading claim is an order that the director compensates the company personally for any deterioration in the company's financial position during the period of wrongful trading. And that's usually assessed by identifying the increase in the net deficit during that period. On this next slide, I try to think about what the justification is for prohibiting wrongful trading in the first place. And I put a passage from Kay and Murray on the slide. And they say that the aim of the wrongful trading provisions in the UK is to stop directors from continuing to trade while their companies are on the slide into insolvency. Doing so, they suggest, hopefully reduces the potential loss suffered by creditors. and the provisions broadly encourage directors to take greater responsibility for their companies when they are in serious financial strife, and by contrast penalises directors who are reckless or cavalier in circumstances where they improperly hope for the best, in circumstances where the company's financial position is simply hopeless. On the next slide, a reminder of where we started back in March 2020, and the point at which it became clear that the COVID-19 virus would continue to spread in the UK without certain restrictions being imposed upon businesses. And you'll no doubt recall that it was the 23rd of March 2020 when a nationwide lockdown was imposed. And also that in the days and weeks prior to that date, an increasing number of restrictions were imposed on businesses, some of which have only been lifted this week. A number of bodies, including the City of London Law Society, gave some consideration to the impact that these restrictions would potentially have on businesses generally, but also in relation specifically to the rules of corporate insolvency. And they were concerned that if viable businesses were not preserved, there would be lasting damage to the wider economy. The authors were particularly concerned about the impact of the wrongful trading provisions in the Insolvency Act. And they felt that directors, wary of subsequent personal liability for wrongful trading, would prematurely or precipitously place their companies into insolvent liquidation due to the temporary impact of the measures implemented to combat COVID-19. And this was thought to be a problem which could well do damage beyond the end of the pandemic. The City of London Law Society report makes two suggestions. One proposal involved making clear, presumably by way of some form of legislative amendment, that when assessing whether a company still had a reasonable prospect of avoiding insolvent liquidation or administration, a director should not be made liable for wrongful trading if, acting reasonably, they misjudged the potential impact of COVID-19 on their business. And the sort of example that they gave is that directors shouldn't be exposed to personal liability for incurring additional indebtedness, for example, under the emergency borrowing arrangements, which at that stage it was clear would be forthcoming. The alternative proposal, which the authors suggested would be easier, was simply to suspend the wrongful trading provisions altogether for a limited period. And you'll note that at the end of the quote on the slide, that the authors considered the existing provisions in relation to fraudulent trading and common law duties would suffice as regards creditor protection during the meantime. On the next slide, you can see the government response. And it was only 2 days later that the business secretary, Alok Sharma, gave a press statement. This was one of the daily press conferences that were typical of the time. And he said that there would be a temporary suspension of wrongful trading. And as you'll see from the passage on the slide, he said that the provision would have retrospective effect from the 1st of March. And he also expressly commented that the other checks and balances would remain so as to ensure that directors fulfilled their duties properly. And so it seems to me that there's an obvious and clear overlap between what the Secretary of State proposed on the 28th of March and what the City of London Law Society had proposed just 2 days earlier. So on this slide, you'll see I set out what the legislative solution was. And this came in the form of Section 12 of the Corporate Insolvency and Governance Act 2020. And I've included subsection 1 on the slide. And you'll note what it says there. In determining for the purposes of Section 214 or Section 246ZB of the Act, the contribution, if any, to a company's assets that is proper for a person to make, the court is to assume that the person is not responsible for any worsening of the financial position of the company or its creditors that occurs during what's described as the relevant period. over the page. The SIGA itself was not enacted then until the 25th of June 2020. And drafts of the bill were actually only available for a short time prior to that announcement. So we all knew for some time that there would be a suspension of wrongful trading coming, but we didn't have a chance until just before enactment to see what that would look like. And as anticipated, the relevant period to which Section 12 referred was indeed retrospective in its character. And it was expressed as being the period from the 1st of March 2020 until the 30th of September 2020. That period came and went, but the pandemic and the associated restrictions on business certainly didn't. As a result, the not particularly simply titled Corporate Insolvency and Governance Act Coronavirus Suspension of Liability for Wrongful Trading and Extension of the Relevant Period Regulations 2020 was brought forward. And this created a further relevant period beginning on the 26th of November 2020. That second relevant period was originally due to run until the 30th of April 2021 and was subsequently extended to the 30th of June 2021. As of now, in late July 2021, there has been no further extension of the relevant period and no new relevant period created. Of course, given what happened last year, that's not to say that that won't happen. However, personally, I think it's unlikely, even if the pandemic continues, that there will be any reimposition of the suspension of wrongful trading. Reflecting on the legislation itself, the first important observation, it seems to me, is that it doesn't actually suspend wrongful trading at all. Wrongful trading claims can still be brought and have been able to be brought throughout the period of the pandemic. What the Corporate Insolvency and Governance Act does is to affect the appropriate quantum, which the court will generally order, in the event that a wrongful trading claim succeeds. So even if the company has traded wrongfully throughout 2020 and 2021, the director will not be liable for any increase in the deficit which arose during the two relevant periods. On a strict application of the legislation, however, a director may still be held liable for an increase in the deficit between September and November 2020. Now, that short period may not make much impact on all that many claims. And in any event, the existing rules in relation to misfeasance and fraudulent trading were not changed at any time. Accordingly, it may be possible to pursue directors personally in respect of the wrongful trading of a company during the pandemic and without any impact on the appropriate quantum. Provided that wrongful trading also constitutes either fraudulent trading or misfeasance. And that at least is the theory. Personally, I think it's quite unlikely, save in an exceptional case, that a director will be held personally liable for keeping a company trading in the hope that the pandemic would shortly pass. It's a hope that many of us have harboured throughout the past 18 months, and the courts are likely to understand that. But that, of course, will depend upon the manner in which the courts exercise discretions, I think, going forwards, rather than on a true construction of what the legislation says. And as a result, it may be many months or perhaps even years before we can really see how the court is grappling with these sorts of issues in the reported authorities. Moving on, another important development in corporate insolvency recently has concerned prepack administrations. And again, I think before looking into the detail of the changes, it's apt to consider what exactly is meant in this context by a prepack administration. A prepack administration is neither an original nor a unique form of insolvency process, It's really just a descriptive term for a subcategory of administrations. As a result, you won't find any statutory definition of a prepack administration in either the Act or the rules. To the extent that there is any generally accepted definition of a prepack administration, it's the one that I've set out on the slide. And it's an arrangement for the sale of all or a substantial part of the company's business prior to the company entering administration. And after that arrangement has been reached, the appointed administrator completes the sale almost invariably on day one of the administration. The purpose of doing so is to rescue the business of the company, either in whole or in part. So what is the issue with prepacks? And this is something that I've dealt with on the next slide. Prepack administrations are fairly common, particularly in certain sectors of the economy. And the most recent statistics suggest that around 29% of all administrations in England and Wales are of the prepack variety, in accordance with the definition I've just provided. And in many prepacks, the pre-arranged sale of the business will be either to a director, a family member of the director, or somebody otherwise closely connected to the company. And furthermore, it's in their nature generally that creditors are unaware until after the sale has taken place. And this can generate a sense of frustration and exclusion on the part of creditors. And this next slide deals with the Graham review of 2014. Theresa Graham was asked to look into prepacks and ultimately produced what is generally referred to as either the Graham review or the Graham report in 2014. That report concluded, in my view, quite fairly, that prepack administrations are a valuable tool for business rescue and were often essential in terms of preserving jobs. It also concluded that the process was cheaper than the only real equivalent option, which is a scheme of arrangement. The report concluded also that, contrary to a number of concerns raised in the consultation, where the consideration under the arrangement is to be deferred, that consideration is usually paid. And then finally, as I say this slightly tentatively, she concluded that prepacks formed part of a functioning, effective insolvency regime, which encouraged companies to have their COMI in the UK. But that said, the report didn't give prepacks an entirely clean bill of health either. And there are a number of matters that were identified as needing improvement. First, it was suggested that the process lacked transparency. Second, it was said that the marketing of businesses needed to improve. Third, it was suggested that a better explanation of the valuation methodology was needed. And then fourth, there was concern that there was a lack of investigation into the viability of the new co, which would be buying the business from old co. And as you'll see from the next slide, the first key recommendation was the establishment of something called the prepack pool. And the idea was that once the pool was established, connected parties on a voluntary basis could approach the pool and disclose the detail of the arrangement to somebody from within the pool. And that person would give an opinion on the arrangement being proposed. On the next slide, I refer to the Small Business Enterprise and Employment Act 2015, SBEER. Now, the government at the time heeded the report, but certainly appeared to be concerned that this recommendation in the form of the establishment of the prepack pool might not be enough. And so what SBEER did was to introduce paragraph 60A into Schedule B1 of the Act. And what section 60A did was to provide the Secretary of State with a power to make regulations which prohibited or imposed conditions upon the disposal of company property to a connected person. And this plainly covers the majority of prepack administrations. The thinking at the time, was that this enabled rules to be imposed fairly quickly by the Secretary of State in the event that Plan A, i.e. the prepack pool, didn't work or didn't work well enough to alleviate the concerns that had been raised. Paragraph 60A was however, time limited and actually expired on the 26th of May 2020, perhaps in fairness at a time when lots of people had something else on their mind. The Corporate Insolvency and Governance Act actually revived paragraph 60A and provides that it will now expire in June 2021. That was the amendment. And then in March 2021, regulations were made. And these are described on the next slide. Again, the somewhat wordily titled Administration Restrictions on Disposal, etc. to Connected Persons Regulations 2021. Those regulations were made under the power I've just described. And these regulations apply to administrations commencing on or after the 30th of April 2021. As regards the scope of the regulations, they apply where an administrator seeks to dispose of a substantial part of a company's business or asset to a connected person within 8 weeks of the start of the administration. It's fair to say 8 weeks would be an unusually long period of time for a sale to take place in a pre-pack administration. And I think the intention, therefore, is that the regulations would have a fairly broad scope and perhaps also it would prevent them from being easily circumvented. Where the regulations apply, the administrator must obtain either creditor approval for the disposal or alternatively a report from the proposed purchaser. The purchaser's report should be prepared by an evaluator and should consider whether the grounds and consideration for the intended disposal are reasonable. And that report will either declare case made or case not made for the disposal. Interestingly, even if the evaluator declares in his or her report case not made, the administrator may still proceed with the sale, provided they provide an explanation for their decision to creditors. Now, this change is also in its relative infancy, and therefore it's perhaps too early to say whether the reforms have really addressed the concerns which creditors have about the transparency and fairness of pre-pack administrations. And again, that's likely to be something that we get a lot more information on in the months and years ahead.
Thank you, Phil. The word unprecedented must be the most appropriate word to be used in light of the last 15 months. It is the next 15 months in which the insolvency profession will be at the forefront, with relief packages reducing and the restriction of running up petitions being released. I'm going to focus on a couple of recent developments that will affect practitioners moving forwards, namely Crown Preference and its effect, Insolvency Act applications and procedure in light of Manley and Barrett. Next slide, please. So, Crown Preference. What was a hot topic, at least pre-pandemic, was reintroduction of Crown Preference. In light of the pandemic, the reintroduction date of 1st of December 2020 was slightly subdued, likely in light of the restrictions to running up proceedings since March 2020. Given the low level of corporate insolvency since, the true knock-on effect of Crown Preference has not been felt, in particular when considering the various relief given to the companies, including deferrals of VAT. So what is Crown Preference? Crown Preference is the return of preferential status to HMRC in respect of VAT, PAYE, income tax, employee national insurance, student loan deductions, and construction industry scheme deductions, effectively known as source taxes. In short, HMRC now jumped the queue to third place in the rankings of the payment under the waterfall, after fixed charges and after cost expenses of the office holder. This was brought into effect by the Finance Act 2020 and an amendment to the Insolvency Act 1986. A point to make is that this is the return of Crown Preference. This is not the first time HMRC have received preferential status, and thus time for a short history lesson. Prior to 2003, HMRC retained preferential status. The points to note on the previous regime was that all unpaid tax debts would receive preferential treatment. However, and a key point, so the maximum of 12 months worth of tax would be claimed, depending on the tax. Crown preference was subsequently abolished by the Enterprise Act 2002, rendering all tax due as unsecured claims in the estate. The Enterprise Act was the same act that also introduced the concept of the prescribed part, whereby part of realisations otherwise available for the holders of floating charges is carved out to be paid to unsecured creditors. The removal of HMRC's preferential status was seen as a counterbalance to the need for floating charge holders to allow a proportion of monies to be held back for unsecured creditors. Accordingly, this time is different. HMRC can only claim preferential treatment in relation to source taxes. However, the amount to be claimed is unlimited. There's been no balancing act akin to the prescribed part within the Enterprise Act, and in fact, the contrary, as the maximum level of the prescribed part was increased by one third from 6th of April 2020 to £800,000. A further key point to note is that this applies against lending already in place prior to 1st December 2020. Next slide, please. So what is the effect on the waterfall? Following the increase in the prescribed part, enactment of SIGA and reintroduction of Crown preference, the order of the waterfall is now as follows. Firstly, fixed charge holders. Secondly, administration and liquidation expenses. Thirdly, preferential creditors, at first starting with the ordinary preferential creditors, thereafter secondary preferential creditors, and this is where Crown preference kicks in, namely unlimited return of unpaid source taxes. Fourthly, we have the prescribed part for unsecured creditors. Fifth is the floating charge holders. Sixth is unsecured creditors, which includes HMRC in respect of non-source taxes. And finally, seventh is shareholders. As a note, the new moratorium procedure introduced by SIGA provides that certain unpaid pre-moratorium debts, when an insolvency process is commenced within 12 weeks, are to be paid after the holder's fixed charges, but before the expense of the administration or liquidation. Accordingly, in that scenario, the pecking order is decreased further. Next slide, please. So what does this mean in practice? Any change to the waterfall will inevitably have a knock-on effect to practitioners. Firstly, access to finance and effect on lending. Once restrictions are lifted for winding up petitions, there will be an increase in funding sought. Lending subject to floating charge holders will be very exposed, especially in a distressed situation where the preferential status to source taxes is now unlimited. Where lending is available, this will likely lead to both increased due diligence but also increased rates. Directors will be faced with a situation whether it is in fact in the interest of the company or creditors when insolvent to take on expensive and burdensome lending. The SME market will be hit the hardest and will likely see more insolvency processes as a result of the reintroduction of Crown preference. To counterbalance this likely increase, there will be reduced distributions to general unsecured creditors and thus a reduced appetite to bring winding up petitions. Without sight of the true financial position of a debtor company, including source tax arrears, unsecured creditors have no visibility on any likely return on winding up proceedings. The reintroduction of Crown preference also means that HMRC has effective control over company voluntary arrangements. Preferential creditors cannot be bound by a CVA without their consent. Prior to 1st December 2020, preferential creditors consisted of employees, but now HMRC have to either be paid in full, alternatively, they have the ability to reject the CVA. This has far-reaching implications. Even if HMRC are paid in full, this may mean there is nothing left in the pot to propose a CVA. The situation is very likely to occur given the deferrals in both VAT and PLE payments over the last 15 months. It remains to be seen what stance HMRC will take in these scenarios. Given the reintroduction of Crown preference, we expect to see future actions in relation to characterisation of fixed and floating charges. Lenders will ultimately seek priority by relying on lending terms and the position of any fixed charges and or crystallisation of floating charges, and thus the terms of the lending are inherently key. It's worth mentioning the case of Reece Spectrum Plus Limited, which caused lenders to review their lending documents. Brief facts are as follows. Spectrum opened an account with NatWest. The account provided an overdraft facility and the debenture was given. The debenture created a fixed charge over all of the book debts due to Spectrum. It required Spectrum to pay all such debts into NatWest's account. The prior written consent of NatWest was required in order for Spectrum to sell, factor, discount, or otherwise charge or assign the book debts in favour of any other person. NatWest also had the ability to require Spectrum to assign the book debts to NatWest on demand. After Spectrum entered liquidation, liquidators collected in all the book debts. Contrary to NatWest's claim to the proceeds under its fixed charge, the creditors of Spectrum claimed that NatWest's charge over the book debt's proceeds was only a floating charge. On appeal, it was held that it was possible to create a fixed charge over book debts. However, NatWest's debenture did not create a fixed charge over the book debt proceeds. The key to this case was that NatWest's debenture required the proceeds of book debts to be paid into NatWest's account, but placed no restriction against the balance on the account thereafter. Accordingly, NatWest was unable to claim that they held a fixed charge over the proceeds of book debts when such proceeds were paid into a normal business account, on which Spectrum could freely remove the sums as it saw fit. The takeaway was that fixed charges over book debts and standard bank debentures were, in fact, floating charges. It is very likely that in the near future, the further challenges will be sought, both for and against fixed or floating charge holders in the race to move up the rankings in the waterfall. Ground preference has to some degree slipped through the net of practitioners' thoughts in light of the last 15 months. Practitioners must, however, be alive to it, especially given its effect on corporate insolvencies. Next slide, please. Now turning to insolvency applications and procedure. Respondents have often turned to procedural flaws in order to defend matters. The matter of Manolet and Barrett has, as it stands, changed the way in which practitioners should issue claims, whether they are both Part 7 claims and Insolvency Act claims, effectively hybrid claims. It has been common practice to issue such hybrid claims via one single Insolvency Act application for both ease and to avoid paying the normal Part 7 claim fee. Following the judgment of ICC Judge Briggs, practitioners must now issue separate Insolvency Act proceedings and Part 7 proceedings where there are claims that cannot be brought under Parts 1 to 11 of the Insolvency Act or the Insolvency Rules. As a precursor, and before I delve into the Manolet case, it's appropriate to first start with the matter of Taunton Logs Limited, which provided the previous challenge to the use of Insolvency Act applications as against Part 7 proceedings. Next slide, please. The relevant facts are as follows. Taunton Logs Limited entered into administration on 14th of June 2018 and thereafter entered creditors upon liquidation on 11th of June 2020. As shown by a return of allotment of shares received at Cumberley's House on 7th of April 2014, between 27th of March and 31st of March, 4.8 million A ordinary shares with a nominal value of £1 each were allotted in the share capital of the company, and the relevant return of allotments showing the shares to be paid for in full. These 4.8 million shares were allotted to the 15 shareholders. It was common ground that the 15 shareholders only personally paid 30% of the nominal value of the shares allotted to them, and the administrators argued there was no evidence that the balance of 70% of the nominal value of the shares was ever paid. Accordingly, by way of an Insolvency Act application, the joint administrators and the company, as applicants, sought declarations that, firstly, pursuant to Section 33 of the Companies Act and the Companies Articles of Association, the respondents, in acquiring their respective shareholders in the company, were obliged to pay to the company the full value of corresponding shareholding. Further, in the alternative, pursuant to Schedule 1 and Schedule B1 of the Insolvency Act, the applicants had called up and or called upon the respondents to pay all unpaid share capital due from each of them to the company. Further, in the alternative, the respondents had not paid to the company a sum equivalent to 70% of the share capital due from them upon the acquisition of their respective shareholders in the company, and each of the respondents are accordingly indebted to the company in the same amount. The administrators sought an order that the respondents shall pay the applicants the sum equivalent to 70% of the share capital due from them. Next slide, please. The 15 respondents brought an application to strike out the Insolvency Act application on the basis that the proceedings were fatally flawed. Respondents argued as follows. Firstly, the true nature of the claim against respondents was a simple debt claim. Secondly, whilst paragraph 19 of Schedule 1 to the Insolvency Act confers power on an administrator to call up any uncalled capital of the company, the court was not presently concerned with that situation because it was not concerned with uncalled capital. The making of a call for money is unpaid in respect of shares, but rather a simple debt claim. Consequently, paragraph 19 was not, in the present circumstances, engaged. Thirdly, insolvency proceedings, which may be brought by way of an insolvency application notice, are provided for by Rule 1.35 of the Insolvency Rule 2016, are confined to applications made specifically under the insolvency rules for the Insolvency Act, in particular Parts 1 to 11. Reliance was also placed on the fact that Rule 1.35 to A and B require the insolvency application to state that is made under the Insolvency Act or the Insolvency Rules, and also state a particular section or rule. The respondents argued that on this basis, whilst a substantive application purports to be an Insolvency Act application, it is not, but it is a nullity and a mere piece of paper having no legal effect. It was not made under the Insolvency Act or the Insolvency Rules, in particular parts 1 to 11 thereof, but merely to pursue what is, in substance, a debt claim. On the basis that proceedings cannot properly be described as insolvency proceedings, respondents opined that the jurisdiction to remedy defects provided for by Insolvency Rule 12.64 cannot be relied upon by the liquidator as he now was, as that provision can only apply to what can be properly described as insolvency proceedings. It was further contended that even if there was jurisdiction to cure any defect, the court should not, in the exercise of its discretion in respect of that jurisdiction, to do so in favour of the liquidator, given what the respondents maintain was the liquidator's abusive conduct. As to this, it was suggested that the use of the insolvency proceeding was a ploy to avoid paying a £10,000 issue fee, which would have been payable on the issue of a Part 7 claim form. It was also said that the liquidator had used a wholly inappropriate and flawed procedure and ought not to be relieved from their own folly. And it was said to grant relief curing the defect will cause the respondents prejudice and involve depriving the respondents of an accrued limitation defence, given that no properly constituted proceedings were commenced within the relevant limitation period. To counter, the liquidator contended that the correct route was in fact taken and was not a ploy to avoid paying a large court fee. Nevertheless, the liquidator contended that even if the respondent was right in relation to paragraph 19, Schedule 1, it is open to the court to rectify that defect either under Insolvency Rule 12.64 or under CPR 3.10. The liquidator relied on Phillips and McGregor Patterson. In that case, liquidators had brought misfeasance action under Part 7 in their own name, which of course liquidators had no personal cause of action. Henderson J opined that the then Insolvency Rule 7.55 could cure a formal defect as the proceedings were plainly insolvency proceedings. Following the arguments raised, His Honour Judge Corson QC sided with the respondents and held that the claim amounted to a simple debt claim. The company's article of association provided that shares should be paid for in full on issue and made no mention of calls on shareholders in respect to partially paid shares. The claim should have been brought by way of the Part 7 claim, as paragraph 19 of Schedule 1 of the Insolvency Act had not been engaged. His Honour Judge Corson QC went further to state that Rule 12.64 of the Insolvency Rules could not be relied on to cure the error, as it applies only to insolvency proceedings. However, the error could be cured under CPR 3.10 with payment of the appropriate court fee. Next slide, please. The matter of Taunton Logs gave pause for thought on the correct procedure in which to bring insolvency claims and the likely pushback to receive in the event the incorrect procedural route was taken. The position has, however, been tested further in the more recent matter of Manley and Barrett, with further implication on the insolvency profession. The facts. The case originated via claims assigned to Manley Partners PLC by the liquidators of Blackwater Plant Limited, allowable following the introduction of Section 246Z of the Insolvency Act. Manley thereafter proceeded to bring various claims by way of an Insolvency Act application, which included a breach of duty claim against both the third and fourth respondents as de jure or de facto directors respectively, referred to as the Blackwater claims. Manley claims that third and fourth respondents breached their duty to Blackwater by allowing or causing preference payments to the first respondent, the second respondent and a connected company. And they breached their duties when allowing Blackwater to provide unsecured credit to a connected company. Next slide, please. The third and fourth respondents sought an unless order requiring Manley to pay the issue fee that would have been payable had the Blackwater claims been commenced via over Part 7 claim form, which the third and fourth respondents regarded as the correct route to take. The respondents argued that Manley had no authority or power to make a claim pursuant to Section 212 of the Insolvency Act, as it did not fall within any of the categories of any person able to make such an application under Section 212, subsection 3. Distinction was drawn between the assets of the company, which may be sold, and the rights conferred by statute upon the liquidator in relation to the conduct of liquidation, re Ayala Holdings Limited applied. Accordingly, Manley could not take an assignment of the position of office. The respondents did, however, alert the court to the fact that a cure was available. Manley could ask the court to treat the application mistakenly including claims under Section 212, and upon payment of the appropriate fee, should be permitted to continue. There is authority for such a course, Taunton Logs Limited applied. Manolet responded, and although distinguishing Taunton Logs on the facts did not include any transaction avoided positions which vested in the office holder, it argued that the approach taken by his honour judge Corson QC was contrary to the established practice, most notably that, firstly, all claims touching or concerning insolvency are capable or should be capable of being brought before one court in one list and before the same judge. CPR 7.3 especially supports this proposition. Any procedure to prevent such autonomy, forcing a claimant to choose a list which does not have a relevant specialist judge when such expertise is required, is inconsistent with that aim. Secondly, on one scenario, there would be two sets of proceedings. They would perhaps seek very similar relief arising from exactly the same facts and matters, but would be appearing in different lists and come before different judge for case management. It is simply illogical to have two sets of proceedings, and such an outcome would lead to a waste of time and court resource, which is contrary to principles in CPR 1.1. It was for those reasons that there was an established practice that all claims concerning insolvency are issued by way of one singular insolvency application, regardless of whether they are transaction avoidance, company or other claims, as supported by case law. In TSB and Katz, Arden J inferred an application under section 423 should be made together with insolvency proceedings. In Re Shalena, where a claim should have been commenced by either part 7 claim form and is included in an insolvency application, the court has discretion to admit the claim to continue where the claim is made as a consequence of the liquidation. The same approach was taken in Reclass of Group Services, but the reason for permitting a Part 7 claim to continue with its insolvency proceedings because it was procedurally convenient or sensible or economical to do so. Next slide, please. ICC Judge Briggs concluded, rather reluctantly, that this long-standing practice in relation to hybrid claims was inappropriate. It was held that Insolvency Act application notices may only be used to issue proceedings brought under Parts 1 to 11 of the Insolvency Act 1986 or the Insolvency Rules 2016. Any other action, even where that action is closely connected with the insolvency proceedings, must be issued separately by way of the Part 7 claim form. In relation to claims under Section 212 of the Insolvency Act, the liquidator has standing to bring an Insolvency Act application. The signee must bring a Part 7 claim. Further, it was confirmed that claims under Section 423 of the Insolvency Act could not be brought by way of an Insolvency Act application, as such a claim falls within Part 16 of the Insolvency Act. Accordingly, such claims must be brought by way of the Part 7 claim. In the Manolet case, the court exercised its discretion to allow the matter to proceed on the basis that the payment of the prevailing court fee for issuing a Part 7 claim was paid by Manolet. ICC Judge Briggs' judgment further provides, I reach these conclusions with regret. The criticisms of the procedure are well made by Mr. Curl. They did not promote a convenient or sensible or economical use of court resource. In modern parlance, the result fails to ensure that the claims of this nature are dealt with expeditiously, allotting an appropriate share of the court's resources. An office holder and assignee of claims will be forced to issue claims arising from insolvency using different procedures in different lists within the business and property courts, with the risk that without a transfer, there will be case managed at least by different judges, although the claims arise out of the same facts. Next slide, please. So what is the effect on practitioners? This will no doubt cause issues of both the funding market and certain cases to be brought by insolvency practitioners where there is a nil asset estate. Where a Part 7 claim is now required, any action outside of Parts 1 to 11 of the Insolvency Act or the insolvency rules, many claims will not be pursued due to the court fee due. In terms of procedure, a separate Insolvency Act application and a Part 7 claim form will be required with an immediate request to amalgamate the proceedings. Many in the insolvency profession share the same thoughts as ICC Judge Briggs, namely that judgment does not promote a convenient or sensible or economical approach. A consultation by the Insolvency Service was in progress until 30th of June 2021, and it remains to be seen whether there will be any proposed changes to insolvency legislation to rectify this issue. In the meantime, practitioners must ensure they have taken the correct approach and the correct route when considering issuing Insolvency Act applications. That brings us to the end of our webinar. We hope you've all enjoyed it. You should have our contact details should you wish to discuss anything further.